The goal for this session is to review the most common errors in E&M or evaluation and management coding that I see as an auditor, and I'll be talking to you from that perspective, someone who's reviewed cardiology notes for over 20 years. You know, it's truly impossible to cover all the details you'll need in a 15-minute podcast, but generally speaking, if you're aware of and understand these most common errors that we will review, chances are you'll be in much better shape. So in acknowledgement of our time limitations, there will be a supplemental slide deck as well as links to some other resources that will be uploaded for your individual review. In this session, I do want to highlight some of the pearls in a concise manner that you can immediately grasp and apply to your next patient encounter. So speaking of audits, I do hope you realize it's not a matter of if you will be audited. It's really more a matter of when and by whom. And odds are great that many of you already have been. Now, we are without a doubt in the age of data analysis, and when it comes to provider's billing patterns, there are a number of ways it can and is being reviewed. So one of those is as pertains to billing for evaluation and management codes, or E&M services. Now, these are the codes that are intended to represent a provider's cognitive clinical services, the history, the exam, the medical decision-making that's associated with a patient encounter, be it in the office, hospital, or other setting, and that's the focus for today. So understanding these guidelines, it's crucial to all healthcare providers, but especially so for the cardiologist who frequently performs complex cognitive services for patients with many impacts of multisystem disease. So documentation of the E&M service, it not only establishes the medical necessity of the visit itself, but it also can and often does establish the medical necessity for the diagnostic and or therapeutic services that are ordered or performed as a result of the E&M findings. Now, CMS, they have one of the most active programs when it comes to a review of data and billing patterns and auditing, but commercial payers are also reviewing patterns and communicating their findings. So with so much data available, there really isn't any reason that you should get caught off guard and find out that you're billing a particular code significantly more frequently than your peers, putting you at an increased risk. I should probably mention that one of the newest CMS programs, the TPE, or Targeted Probe and Educate Program. Now, this is a newer approach started this year, and it's intended to give a provider one-on-one feedback if necessary to increase the accuracy of your claim submission. Now, the TPE review process, it includes three rounds of a prepayment probe review with education. So you can be released from further review after any round if your documentation shows the required improvement. Now, if there are continued high errors after three rounds, you can be referred to CMS for additional actions, which could include a 100% prepayment review, an extrapolation of your audit results, referral to a recovery auditor, and bottom line, you really want to pass in that first round. So I've already met a handful of practices that are now in round two of this review. And it doesn't matter in these cases if you're considered to have been overcoded or undercoded. An error is an error, and both count against you. So the goal for coding E&M and other services, you know, obviously, is to identify and submit the code that accurately and completely represents the service rendered. But equally important is to ensure that you've documented your service appropriately. I often see documentation deficiencies that I believe really are due to providers simply not understanding. You know, what are the data elements that must be separately documented and are critical for proper coding? You take that, combine that with what many believe to be the inherent complexity of the E&M coding, it can make it pretty difficult for a busy clinician to always ensure they're selecting the correct code. So it's sad but true that omission of a critical element, it can preclude your ability to code a specific service. And can require that service to be coded at a lesser valued code just in order to be in compliance with guidelines. So, you know, you as the clinicians, you are ultimately accountable and responsible for submitting the correct code regardless of who you may have delegated that task to. I've met physicians who'll say, well, that's why I hire coders. Well, okay, that's definitely the right thing to do, but it is your name on the claim. Now, no one's suggesting that, you know, one of our goals is to turn clinicians into coders. But, you know, you owe yourself the information, the education, and the tools that you'll need in order to accurately and completely report your services. And time again, I've seen some of the greatest documentation and compliance problems They really seem to come from what the physicians say. They just simply didn't know. But as providers, you are held liable to a standard that says you knew or should have known. And in today's compliance world, that basically means it's been communicated in some manner. So you've all read every rule and regulation there is, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, E&M services, they represent that most common service that you're likely to be rendering. You don't have to like it, but you do need to master the application of the documentation and coding guidelines in order to be successful in today's healthcare environment. So, you know, if we consider that pre- and post-payment reviews and audits are increasingly prevalent, many of you are likely to have a compensation model that takes work RVU into account in some manner. You really just owe it to yourself to optimize your coding while minimizing your risk. So good documentation is an essential defense for many, many, many reasons. Now, one great way to know where you stand with your E&M billing pattern is to reference the data that CMS makes available on billing patterns per specialty. The most current data available is for 2016, and it does show cardiology, electrophysiology, and interventional cardiology and the expected ratios and percentages for each of the E&M code categories. You can easily do a review and compare your own billing data, quickly get a feel for anywhere area where you're billing significantly different from your peers. Ask your billing or auditing representative for a report on how you can compare, and I will be including links to the Target Probe and Educate program as well as the link to the CMS data in the supplemental slide deck. All right, so enough of that. Bottom line, we want to do the right thing. We all do. We want to ensure we're accurately capturing and reporting the services rendered when it comes to evaluation and management of our patients. And truly, a necessary step in doing that is just ensuring you know and you can understand and document accordingly. So at this point, let me point out some of the top errors associated with each of the three key elements of E&M coding. Now, those key elements are history, examination, and medical decision-making. Now, within history and examination, there are multiple options, such as problem-focused, expanded problem-focused, detailed, and comprehensive. Within medical decision-making, there are options for straightforward, low, moderate, and high complexity. The definition of these terms, they're critical for you, as these apply to E&M levels in any setting, such as the office, the hospital, for example. So in addition to the E&M levels and their definitions, there's a few basic rules associated with the various code sets themselves. So for example, the definition of a new patient versus an established patient and how this in turn impacts your coding. Now, one of the most common errors I see is associated with a new patient visit and maybe the level 4 service. So if you're picking your level with the same thought process, whether or not you're making the distinction between, oh, but this is a new patient versus an established patient, whatever thought process you're applying as you pick your level of service, if you're not making that distinction, you could very well be overcoding all your new patient visits because the guidelines for the different levels are not the same. So a new patient is one who has not received a professional service from a provider of the same group and same specialty in the past 3 years. Now, I've seen this used inappropriately on that initial visit in the office following a hospital service. So let's say a cardiologist from your group who's the same specialty, if they have seen the patient in the inpatient setting, so then when the patient presents to the office for the first time, they are an established patient, not a new patient. Even though this may represent a, quote, new chart or the first time they've been seen in your office because, as the guidelines state, they have received a professional service face-to-face from a physician of the same specialty within the past 3 years. Now, by the same token, if the patient has been lost to follow-up and it's now been greater than 3 years since they've last been seen, well, you would qualify for a new patient visit again when they reestablish their care. So the distinction of requirements for new versus established patient, that's just another common problem area. And basically because the new patient encounter, as well as the initial hospital encounter and the consultation codes, do require that you bill at a level that you meet all three out of three of the key components. So the impact here is that for a new patient E&M, both the level 4 and the level 5 require a comprehensive history and a comprehensive exam. So the only distinguishing factor there is the medical decision-making of either moderate for a 4 or high complexity for a 5. Now, when it's an established patient visit, the history and exam need only be detailed, and you can bill at the level that you meet 2 out of 3 components for that level 4, for example. So if you are one review assistant short on a comprehensive history and it's a new patient, you are now limited to only the detailed history, and that represents a level 3 new patient. So in the initial inpatient encounter, what used to be known as the admission codes, both the level 2 and level 3 require a comprehensive service. So omitting just one factor in that comprehensive history, that's now going to limit your billing option, even on your sickest patient, to the lowest level, the 99221, the level 1 encounter, because you haven't met 3 out of 3 of the key elements. So let's just review the requirements of the comprehensive history, because I can say without a doubt, the number one issue I see for cardiology is history. And most often it's related to not having the required number of systems in a comprehensive review of systems or missing a required element from past family or social history. So if we start with just the most basic required element, the chief complaint. All E&M encounters require a chief complaint. The expectation is that this will be in the patient's own words, especially when they're being seen for a symptom, a problem, or some type of condition. And it could also be a physician-recommended return. And when that's the case, what is needed is a concise statement to represent why they're being seen. Don't stop, though, with just follow-up. Patients here for follow-up. You need to go on to state follow-up of multiple medical conditions to include heart failure, atrial fibrillation, or whatever the case may be. So the components of a history start with HPI, or the history of present illness. And this is expected to include description of the development of the patient's signs, symptoms related to that chief complaint. So descriptions such as the location, quality, severity, duration, timing, context, modifying factors, associated signs and symptoms. That's what needs to be listed here. So the comprehensive history, it requires 4 elements in that HPI in order to establish an extended HPI. So brief and extended HPIs are distinguished by the amount of detail that's needed to characterize the clinical problem. So brief is just 1 to 3 elements. Extended is at least 4, and that's what you're going to need for the comprehensive history. So just one sentence. You know, for example, patient complains of severe substernal non-radiating with when you're describing that chief complaint of chest pain. You're going to need those 4 elements for an extended history, and that's what's required for both detailed and or comprehensive history. So bottom line, your pearl here, describe any patient complaint 4 different ways. Now, review of systems. This is easily the number one problem area for cardiology from my perspective. And options for review of systems include either a pertinent, which is 1 system, an extended, 2 to 9 systems. Now, that's a huge spread. Or the big one, a complete review of systems defined as needing 10 or more systems. So specifically, when a comprehensive history is required, you're going to need to have 10 systems in your review of systems. So what seems to be much more typical for cardiology, according to the audits that I've conducted, is to have 7 to 8 systems in your review of systems. So please challenge yourself and count your systems. You know, you have your most typical spiel that you use when you dictate. Count the systems in your most typical dictation. Do you mention 10? Or do you need to add a few more? So without 10 in your review of systems, you can't bill above a level 1 initial inpatient encounter in the hospital. You can't bill a level 4 or level 5 new patient in the office or a level 5 established patient. So here, it's really important to know what your Medicare MAC, the Medicare Administrative Contractor who processes the claims in your state, it's important to know what they have to say about what they will and won't accept within a review of systems. So many, in fact, probably most, will accept a comment such as, all others of a 10 system review are negative, except as documented above. Now, when that is accepted, it'll be only after you've already made line item comments on the most directly impacted systems. Now, I would caution you on not doing that line item review of systems. It is perfectly acceptable to just include all those elements in your HPI, but I can tell you that particular documentation style does have a tendency to be some of the most frequently overcoded services. I think you just feel like there are more comments up in that first paragraph than there really are. So I would caution you against that, although it is perfectly acceptable. Now, past family social history, that's the final history element. And this is also an area that tends to be in the top three as causing problems. So for comprehensive history, you're going to need one comment from each of those areas. Past history, that's never a problem. That includes, you know, the medication, the allergies, previous admissions, their various medical problems. But what does create the greatest problem is in an inpatient setting with a patient who's in an acute presentation of illness on a particular encounter. So it may seem that that family history, for example, it's just not even pertinent because the patient's already presenting with that MI, for an example. But if you leave it out, well, now you're limited, again, to only that lowest level initial encounter because both the level 2 and 3 need that comprehensive history and also billing at all 3 out of 3 key elements. So my suggestion to you would be to just get into the habit of documenting risk factors. If you do that, that's going to help in making sure you don't miss those frequently missed ones of either the family or social history that's going to be needed to support a comprehensive history. And I should probably mention, too, that the guidelines do take into account the fact that the patient may not be able to provide you with the necessary history elements. Now, if that's the case, you just need to document that. You know, state that they're intubated, confused, sedated, whatever the case may be, and that will give you credit for having completed that comprehensive history. The guidelines also allow you to make reference to a patient-completed form, if that might be the case, or even to a previously completed history. But when you do so, you need to specifically reference that, and that will then pull that documentation into today's encounter. Now, final comment here, the guidelines do also provide that clinical staff can assist you in the documentation of a couple of history elements. Your staff can assist with documenting review of systems, as well as past family or social. However, you're the one who needs to document the chief complaint and the HPI, and you're accountable for the accuracy of what someone else may document on your behalf in that review of systems or the past family social. I often see conflicting information in the HPI and review of system. You know, I'll see, you know, patient complains of chest pain in review of system, and then patient denies chest pain in the HPI or vice versa. So conflicting information can also be interpreted and treated as suspect for cloned and or copy-paste documentation. It's fine to use templates, and you can do that to assist with your documentation, but you must take the time on each patient encounter to ensure that that documentation is updated with information that is unique to that patient encounter on that particular given day. Failure to do so can jeopardize your entire note, as they'll just throw that out and say that was a cloned document. Okay, so let's move on to examination. Honestly, you know, that just doesn't cause nearly the amount of problems as I see with history and or medical decision making, but I do want to make a few brief comments here. A comprehensive examination is going to require findings from 8 different systems. Now, that's under the 1995 guidelines. Your other option is to use the 97 guidelines with much more specific and detailed elements. Now, from an auditing perspective, we're instructed to follow the guidelines that are in the best interest of the provider, and truly, that is typically the 1995 guidelines for cardiology, especially when it comes to that comprehensive examination. Now, where I do see that exam findings can cause a problem is more typically in the inpatient setting, and that's when a detailed examination is required, and that would be at the level 3 hospital follow-up. So as you're aware, there's only 3 levels of subsequent inpatient care, and, you know, for the first couple days following an admission, you're very likely to bill at that level 3 level. That's when the patient is still stabilizing or you're still working with them And then, you know, as they go through their admission, your levels of service will likely drop. So what may be a level 3 the day after admission, maybe a level 2 the next day, maybe a level 2 the next day, then a level 1, and then discharge. You know, we kind of expect the levels to shift and change as the patient stabilizes and improves. Now, one of the gray areas with examination is how to define an expanded examination from a detailed examination. So it's anticipated that one of those factors is going to be the detail in which a given system is documented. So just a good habit to get into is just never have less than 2 comments for any system that you want to be given credit for. It's better yet, have 4 comments on a system that you consider to be an impacted system. Now, some of the Medicare MACs, they use a method they refer to as the 4x4, where unless they are able to identify at least 4 systems with 4 comments per system, you're not going to be given credit to a detailed examination. Now, that's not in the CMS documentation guidelines. That's just how they have found a way to make a distinction between expanded and detailed. Every MAC, however, expects to see that in the detail in which the system is described. So my suggestion to you for a detailed examination, I'd say at least 5 systems, 4 comments, that's detailed, keeping in mind that when you need a comprehensive exam, now you're going to need 8 systems. And it's a good idea to have at least 2 comments, better yet 4, on each of those systems. So the last area is medical decision making. And truly, this can be one of the most difficult for an auditor and a clinician alike to establish, as it refers to the complexity of establishing your diagnosis and or selecting what your management options are. So it's measured a couple of different ways. One, by the number of possible diagnoses and the number of management options that have to be considered, the amount and or the complexity of the medical records or diagnostic tests or information that you have to obtain, review, and analyze, as well as then the risk of complications, morbidity, mortality, as well as the comorbidities associated with that patient's presenting problem. Procedures, the different management options, all of those things are what is taken into consideration when it comes to medical decision making. Now, medical decision making is to be the overarching criteria. So you want to pick your level of service based on medical necessity. Now, of course, you know, especially in today's electronic charts, it's pretty easy to document a comprehensive history, comprehensive exam, but is that really going to be necessary when the patient's doing great, no problem, no complaints, you're not making any changes? That shouldn't be a level 5 just because you had a comprehensive history and exam. You want to base your decision, choose your codes on what was medically necessary for the patient, and that's where you make that up. So those 3 pieces that make up the medical decision-making. The first is diagnosis and management options. Now, this is where you need to clarify the problems that you're addressing in a given encounter in such a way that we can tell, is this a new problem for the patient? Is it an established problem for the patient? Is it one that's improving or getting worse? Because a new problem is assumed to be more complex than an established. A problem that requires additional workup is assumed to be more complex than one that you're not doing anything about. Even if it's an established problem, but it's getting worse, well, then that's more complex than one that's stable. So each of these areas have, you know, quote, points assigned to them. And a score of 4 in this category means you've maximized your scoring. So if, for example, you have a new problem and you're planning to do additional workup, that's worth 4 points. You just maxed out that category. Now, if we look at the next area, that's data. So the data review. So here there are categories that kind of give you credit for that information that you review and you have to take into consideration. So the guidelines attempt to assign a value to that various types of data. So there's categories for labs, for example, x-rays, for reviewing old records, credit for discussing things with performing physician or another provider. You actually get additional credit for your personal review of an image versus just reading a review and a report. So bottom line, mention what you review. If you look at their last lab result as compared to previous, if you pull up an image, if you personally review that image or an EKG, well, then reflect that by saying, my review of echocardiogram, you know, reflects that gets you extra credit. So the final area then is risk. And this is broken into three areas. Now, it's kind of provided as a guide because truly this is pretty subjective. It includes three categories to include the presenting problem, diagnostic procedures ordered, and then management options that are selected. Now, most common as to causing problems here is making that distinction between moderate complexity and high complexity. So I just kind of want to highlight those two and just mention again that we are going to include the link to the CMS guidelines as well as a slide deck that'll go through this information in a little more detail and you can review it on your own. But if we look at table of risk, this is that last piece of medical decision making, and we start with presenting problem. The moderate level, it gives us examples of one or more chronic illnesses with mild exacerbation, progression, or side effects. Another option is two or more stable chronic illnesses. Truly, how many cardiology patients don't have one of those two? We can without a doubt say this is going to represent a significant majority of our patient population. There's another, you know, four options there as well under presenting problems, but considering we've already met two of those, we'll just move on. So let's look at management options. So for less than moderate, if I were to look at minimal management options, that includes things like rest, gargles, elastic bandages, not your typical cardiology patient. If we look at low, that's over-the-counter drugs, minor surgery, physical therapy, again, not our typical cardiology patient. So let's look at what moderate says. Minor surgery with identified risk factors, elective major surgery, prescription drug management. How many of your patients are you seeing where you're not managing at least one prescription? So the key here is just making it clear that you are the one that's managing at least one of those medications. You can say, you know, patient's doing fine on their current ACE and ARBs. We'll make no adjustments at this time. So you're given credit for prescription drug management whether you make a change or you decide not to make a change. Either way, you're managing that prescription. We just need to know that you considered it. And, you know, the patient's stable on their current therapeutic regime or some comment that lets us know you would have adjusted the med had you needed to. So then the upper category there is what did you order? You know, what are the diagnostic procedures that are ordered on that day? So if we go all the way back up to minimal, that's when we're talking about things like just lab tests, chest x-rays, urine tests. Low would be, it gives examples of tests not under stress, non-cardiovascular imaging. So let's look at what it says for moderate. That's where we see physiological tests under stress. Example, cardiac stress test, diagnostic endoscopies, deep needle incisional biopsy, cardiovascular imaging studies with contrast and no identified risk factors. Example, cardiac cath. And let me stop right there. I've met a lot of providers that'll say, well, anytime I order cath, I automatically bill a level 5. Well, that's, as you see right there, ordering a cardiac cath is not an automatic level 5. That's moderate medical decision making. Now, if we go down to what is considered high, now we see in that same area, cardiovascular imaging studies with contrast with identified risk factors. We also see cardiac EP tests there. So it's not risk factors unique to the procedure. It's risk factors unique to the patient. So I just want to point that out, that ordering a cath is not an automatic level 5 in medical decision-making, and, of course, you would still need the history and or exam to support that. So what else takes it to a level 5? If we look at the presenting problem, that's where we see one or more chronic illnesses with severe exacerbation, progression, or side effects of disease, an acute or chronic illness or injury that pose a threat to life and or bodily function. Example, multiple trauma, acute MI. You know, so we do have examples there as well. And let's look at what our management options are for high. That's where we see elective major surgery, open percutaneous with identified risk factors, emergency major surgery, parenteral controlled substances, drug therapy requiring intensive monitoring for toxicity, DNR orders. So I hope you'll agree with me that, you know, there is a significant number of our patient population that's going to be at that moderate for risk and medical decision making. So now we need to have, at a minimum, the detailed history and exam to match up to that, unless we're looking at new patients, consults, or hospital admissions, where we still need the comprehensive history and exam at even the moderate level of medical decision making. So one last comment. I mentioned the consult codes. Okay, so from a coding perspective, the consultation codes, they're going to contain those same documentation requirements of needing 3 out of 3, basically the history, exam, medical decision-making levels that match up to a new patient, and you need the added piece of who requested your services and for what particular condition. That must be documented, and then giving that opinion back to the other provider. And I'm sure I just heard some of you say, or at least think, well, I thought we couldn't bill consultation anymore. Well, you can't. You can't submit the code to Medicare or Medicaid, but you can to all the commercials. That's another thing I keep seeing, that people just stopped billing it to the Humanas and the Cignas and the Aetnas and all those commercial payers of the world. So don't forget, you can still bill a consult. It's just that Medicare won't accept that code for your service. You bill the service, but with a different code. All right, so I am out of time for this broadcast. There's so much more I could share with you, but I would feel remiss if I didn't at least mention one comment about the need to pay close attention to your diagnosis code selection. As we begin our conversion from a payment based on quality versus volume, it is more important than ever before that you assign the correct diagnosis code to each patient encounter to the highest degree of specificity that you know. Also report those comorbidities that factor into your decision-making. Your diagnosis coding now can and is impacting your payment in the future. But that's another topic for another podcast. Thank you for your participation.